A philosopher walks down from a mountain after 10 years of solitude, carrying news that will shatter civilization's foundation. But instead of finding eager listeners, he encounters a crowd more interested in watching a tightrope walker. This is how Nietzsche begins one of philosophy's most electrifying and misunderstood works. Zarathustra's message isn't just that God is dead, it's that we killed him, and now we're orphaned in a universe without cosmic meaning. Picture standing in a cathedral where the ceiling has been ripped away, exposing an indifferent cosmos. That vertigo, that terror mixed with strange exhilaration, that's the starting point. Most people, Nietzsche suggests, haven't truly grasped what this means. We're still living on the credit of values whose bank has collapsed. The death of God isn't a triumph to celebrate or a tragedy to mourn. It's a diagnosis of where we actually stand, whether we admit it or not. When Zarathustra introduces the Übermensch, he's pointing toward human possibility beyond current limitations. Like a caterpillar that can't imagine becoming a butterfly, humans aren't finished products, but bridges to something greater. The Übermensch creates values rather than inheriting them from tradition or divine command. After carrying the dead tightrope walker, Zarathustra realizes he needs companions who will inscribe new values on new tablets. This transformation happens through three metamorphoses. First, we're camels bearing inherited culture's heavy burdens. Then, we become lions, roaring "I will" against tradition's "thou shalt." Finally, we become children, possessing what Zarathustra calls innocence and forgetting, a new beginning. Children create without resentment or guilt, playing freely with possibilities. This isn't about transcending humanity, but fulfilling its deepest potential. Becoming fully human means becoming more than what we currently call human. Zarathustra discovers that everything alive speaks one language, the will to power. This isn't about domination, but the fundamental drive to overcome oneself, to grow and expand. A tree pushing through concrete, an artist perfecting their craft, a child learning to walk, all express this force. Life whispers its secret. I am that which must always overcome itself. Real virtue isn't conforming to external rules, but transforming your power creatively. Your anger at injustice can become fierce compassion. Your selfishness can become self-respect that radiates outward. In The Vision and the Enigma, Zarathustra sees a shepherd choking on a black snake, nihilism crawling down his throat. The solution isn't gentle removal, but violent action. Bite its head off. Afterward, the shepherd laughs as no human has laughed before. This laughter represents the joy of self-mastery, the exhilaration of conquering what threatened to destroy you. True power doesn't make you grim, it makes you dance. Imagine two paths stretching into eternity, one backward, one forward. If time is infinite but matter finite, everything must recur endlessly. This is eternal recurrence, not cosmology, but an existential test. Could you embrace living your exact life, every triumph and humiliation infinitely? Not once more, but forever? The thought initially horrifies Zarathustra. He envisions the eternal return of the small man, those who live for comfort, avoid risk, and settle for mediocrity. Must even this pettiness recur eternally? Yet he transforms horror into affirmation. In The Seven Seals, he declares his love for eternity like wedding vows. Oh, how could I not be ardent for eternity and for the marriage ring of rings, the ring of the return? This isn't passive acceptance, but active embrace, choosing to love life so completely that you'd will its eternal repetition. Eternal recurrence separates life affirmers from life deniers, those who can bear existence's weight from those who cannot. It demands we create lives worthy of infinite repetition, not through accumulating pleasures, but through acts of creation that transcend time itself. Zarathustra attacks morality's foundation itself. There have been many different tables of good and evil, he observes. Greeks valued competitive excellence. Others prized archery or honoring parents. Each people invented values reflecting their will to power, their drive to flourish. Morality isn't discovered in heaven, but created on earth. This enables a radical critique of slave morality, particularly Christianity's elevation of weakness, pity, and humility. The preachers of death promote values that diminish life's vitality. Against this, Zarathustra rehabilitates what Christianity condemned. Voluptuousness becomes garden happiness, passion for power becomes the force driving achievement, and selfishness becomes the wholesome virtue of the powerful soul. Even pity receives harsh treatment. Zarathustra declares that God died of his pity for humanity. Excessive compassion weakens both giver and receiver, creating resentment rather than gratitude. True love helps others become stronger rather than merely alleviating suffering. In Old and New Tables, Zarathustra calls for smashing both traditional morality's commandments and nihilism's despair. In their place, values that enhance life and power, not universal laws, but principles for those seeking greatness and self-overcoming. Zarathustra warns of two futures: ascending toward the Übermensch, or declining into the last man, the endpoint of comfort-seeking, where people settle for small pleasures and security, avoiding all risk. One still works, for work is a pastime, he mockingly describes, but one is careful lest the pastime should hurt one. These diminished humans have their little pleasures for the day and their little pleasures for the night, but no greater aspirations. They've invented happiness, they blink, and they're done. Lives organized around streaming services and dopamine hits, where the greatest ambition is comfortable retirement. Against this mediocrity, Zarathustra champions higher men, not yet the Übermensch, but those striving beyond conventional limitations. In part 4, various higher men gather in his cave: kings disgusted with democracy's leveling, a scientist devoted to truth, a magician torn between authenticity and performance. Each represents partial progress, yet remains incomplete, still succumbing to melancholy, still worshiping false idols, still lacking full affirmation. When a lion appears and frightens them away, Zarathustra realizes they're merely bridges, not his true disciples. His real children are still coming. We inherit a world where traditional meaning has collapsed, but its ghost still haunts us. We're told to be good without knowing why, to seek happiness without understanding what it means. Zarathustra offers no comfort, only a challenge. Can you create meaning where none exists? Can you affirm life so completely that you'd will its eternal return? This isn't about selfishness or cruelty. It's about courage, the courage to face existence without metaphysical safety nets, to create values rather than inherit them, to transform suffering into strength. The question isn't whether you agree with Nietzsche's philosophy, but whether you're living a life you could joyfully repeat forever. Are you a camel bearing others' burdens, a lion fighting for freedom, or a child creating new possibilities? Most of us remain camels, occasionally roaring like lions in private frustration. Yet Zarathustra's message persists: you are something that shall be surpassed by yourself. The great noontide approaches. Will you create or merely consume? Will you dance or merely shuffle? As Zarathustra descends from his mountain one final time, he carries not answers, but an invitation to become worthy of the earth, to love fate, to say yes to life in all its terrible beauty. Your move.